welcome back to another episode of the Hip Hop Social Worker Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Scott. And today I got a special guest, my man, Bashe Williams, LCSW, from the East Coast. I'm not sure where you're from on the East Coast. Where
you represent? Originally from New York, but I'm in Maryland, D.C. area.
Okay, yes, sir. And man, like I told him before, you know, start rolling, you know what I'm saying? He's like the big homie in social work, you know what I'm saying? He's been putting it down for a little minute. And, you know, when I started this journey, you know, he was one of the, he's one of the accounts that I came across. And I was like, man, he's doing a lot of work. He's definitely career goals, everything goals, you know what I'm saying? So he can tell you better than I can. So go ahead, brother, introduce yourself, please.
Appreciate that intro, man. Yeah, like I said, I'm Paul Bashe Williams, licensed clinical social worker in the DMV area. That's DC, Maryland, and Virginia, where I own and operate Hearts and Mind Counseling. My platform is Bashe Williams on everything from YouTube to Instagram to Facebook. Social work is my thing. Been trying to get the fellas in social work for a minute because, you know, coming from the hood and loving everything about hip hop. And, you know, it's always been in our language, always been in our music. But yeah, so I'm also an author, Dear Future Wife, A Man's Guide and A Woman's Reference to Healthy Relationships, because I love everything about relationships and try to connect with the fellas about how we show up in relationships sometimes. So I do a lot of stuff on that. But yeah, I mean, that's me in a nutshell without going too deep into it. That's social work is my thing. But yeah, that's me.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that. So, you know, I remember you had kind of had an Instagram post, and you was kind of say like how you kind of started social work and like things you was doing, that, you know, to kind of like, you know, like I think at the beginning of your career, you said that you was like you was still like kind of promoting, you know what I'm saying? Like to kind of like carry, like, you know what I'm saying? You know, the practice, you know, cause you all know social workers, like you said, like that first job might not hit like you, you know, like it's supposed to. So, you know, so I kind of understood that, but you said you had to kind of make that, you know, like make that, you know, like choice to kind of like, you know, if I'm gonna do this, I gotta do it right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely had to make a choice, man. I was, like you said, it wasn't hitting when it first coming out of the gate. So, you know, graduate with a master's and they talking about like 40 something thousand. I'm like, in Montgomery County at the time, it was like the second richest county in America. And on top of that, you know, I like a certain lifestyle. So, you know, I wanted to come out with a master's and say like, it looked like I got a master's degree. So my job wasn't paying me. I had a master's degree. So, but I always had connected because I used to throw parties when I was in college to like get some extra income. And so one of my homeboys, he was a promoter. And then he was like, I want you to be president because, you know, you got a reach because I used to hoop. And so whenever I used to come back, we used to throw parties together. So when I got there, again, I started to really be engulfed in doing both. But it was too much. Like I'm seeing clients during the day and I'm telling them, you know, you got to watch your intake of your substances, your drinks. And then I'm going and I'm throwing shots up and we popping bottles. It was a couple of times where a client's mother showed up and tried to get in. She was like, oh, that's my son's counselor. Can you get me in? And she just had a birth certificate. And I'm at like the door, like trying to get some people in. I was like, man, it's starting to hit. So I kind of played the background role while I was doing the parties thing. And I didn't want my name on a lot of different things. Because again, conflict of interest in there. I'm telling people, you know, it was just eating me up. And so, but I needed the bread. You know, I had a son who was just born, so I needed that supplemental income as well. But again, it got to a point where I was missing time with him. I was showing up sometimes. Again, like if it was a good night, I was showing up kind of like dreading and tired, hungover or whatever. And I was just like, "Yo, this is too much. I got to make a choice and find a way I can just grind." Within the field and still make that difference and connect to the community.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that was an original question I was going to ask you, but I remember seeing that and saying like in this field, it gets tough, you know what I'm saying? Especially when we got to, you know, bust moves to kind of, you know, make ends meet. Right. And I went through that last year. I was working like five jobs because I got laid off from a job that had a nice paycheck. So I'm trying to like, you know, supplement the income. And I remember like just kind of sitting down, like, you know what, I'm gonna go ahead and take this one job. I'm gonna just take the hit right now, and hopefully, and whenever I come out of this, I'll be cool. And that's what happened. You know what I'm saying? Like, now I'm all right. I ain't gotta, you know, work 5 or 10 jobs, or, you know, so well, not 5 or 10, but, you know, a lot, a grind. You know what I'm saying? Because this work is a grind. Yeah.
But it's still that common, and we still got that mentality to work hard. I was just actually talking to my therapist on Monday. When I came to him in 2018, he just talked about how burnt out I was. Because in this field, even when you got a decent paying job, it's still like, just because our hearts are like, we got to continue to help. Like, how can I continue to help? So I'm stretching myself. So I just started my practice. I was seeing like 15 clients a week. I was working with child welfare 40 to 50 hours a week. And then I was doing hospital psych work like every other weekend for Saturday and Sunday. So I was on that grind because I said, you know what, let me stack before I jump out there. Mm-hmm. But it was still that mentality. And then when I jumped out there, I was like, well, I worked all these hours for all these other people. Now let me work all these hours for myself. So I just continued that like grind. I got to hustle. Now we just transition this into, you know, the practice when I didn't really have to. But that's, yeah, again, even people with comfortable jobs, they go to side jobs. Like if you're working for an agency, then you're doing something at the hospital. You're working for the hospital, then you're doing something for, you know, a small private practice or a nonprofit. And so we just like in this mentality of we just got to do everything all the time. And some of it is money driven, but some of it is just that mentality. A lot of us social workers and misconceptions we think we have to do to get to a certain space.
And that's real, you know. But why did you choose social work?
Actually, bro, it really chose me. I'm going to say that. And I know a lot of that's kind of like cliche. But, you know, again, growing up in, you know, low impoverished neighborhoods, it was this dude. My mother was a property manager. We lived in one of the worst communities in Montgomery County. Where it was like a trailer park behind us. We lived in the gate. There was police at the front and security at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And we used to have you had a program to come in and kind of take the kids out so they can experience different things. Or the social worker comes in and holds groups. So it was this guy, he's still my mentor to this day, actually, a white redheaded gay dude that was in there. And he was already getting, you can't come into the hood like that anyway. So he was already getting like pushed back and a lot of pressure from just like, whether it was the hustlers, whether it was other dads, whether it was moms, like why you around our boys and stuff like that. He's just trying to run a program through the agency he worked for. And so he had a couple of us come and kind of lead the groups. And so I used to be sitting in the back, like, I don't want to really participate. And so he used to always call me out and be like, help facilitate the group, but it came natural. And then, so I was just kind of like led in those spaces. And then I went to school. When I heard about what social workers make, I was like, this ain't what I'm not about to be, you know, going back to the hood. So I was like, let me try law. Let me try business, try physical therapy. And I didn't feel passionate about it. And then I worked for the same mentor. He hired me my freshman summer. Or after my freshman year, and at a therapeutic camp. So the beginning of the camp, I was an admin doing the numbers up the front. By the end of the camp, I was a counselor. I was like, all right, this is it. But again, I go back to school and I switched to the major. And I took a marriage and family class. And I was like, all right, this is what I love. But then I saw them numbers again. And I was just like, again, man, it ain't really no money. That was my mentality. But then he schooled me because at that time, he was like maybe 20 something and he was making like 114, like as a social worker. But he was a social worker and he was a teacher. So he had two jobs. So I was like, you grind. Okay, I can get it. But then he left the teaching job and then he was like, I can get you, you know, where you want to be. And matter of fact, after you finish your schooling, I'm going to hire you you can take over half my practice. So that's my motivation. So I'm not like, all right, now I can see money. So I went through it, but it was less about the money and more about the process of getting the the bachelor's, then I got a scholarship to get my master's. And then when I came out, he was like, oh, but you got to get your license. So I go get the first license. He was like, and then he hired me, but he was like, you got to get your next license if you want to get like be in total proper regularity and full control. So that's when I kind of switched, and I knew I couldn't reach that again, throwing parties and stuff like that. It just wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the beginning of your career, you went straight to the practice, like, or did you like work like, you know, like most of us work like, you know, group home, nonprofit, maybe midnight shift at a hospital, you know what I'm saying? Like, so like, go ahead and break down like the beginning of your career, you know?
So the first job that I got, I was working at a, I guess a retirement facility. It was like hospice. And so I only did that for like a week and a half. I was just like, nah, this ain't it. Like just seeing like people, you know, dying. And then I had a weak stomach for certain smells and stuff like that. So I was just like, I just can't do it. But the next job was actually, it was a dope job because it was for an independent living program. And I came in and they just revamped it. They moved it to a new neighborhood. And so I was a social worker there. And so I was in charge of all the boys. And so it was like a 21 youth program. They were staying in apartments. And basically I was helping them kind of like navigate as, you know, being a big mentor, being a social worker, helping them with different things. So I was just like, all right, this is my niche. And I can relate, and we can relate to people. You know, some people were doing juvenile services, people just displaced. So it was a good experience from that point of view. And then, but the program, like a lot of programs, it kind of folded. Mm-hmm. So, but before it folded, we didn't have a manager and we didn't have another social worker. So I was like running that joint by myself for like 8 months. And so it gave me a taste. It was like, all right, I could start my own. Like I could do my own independent living thing. And it also gave me the taste of what it looked like to run my own business. So after I left that, and then I went into wraparound services. And that was pretty dope too, the experience, because I worked with the pre-adjudicated youth, everybody that I was dealing with, you know, whether they were just first offenders or just released from, or they had drug court or whatever it is. So I was in the homes and I was kind of helping, you know, some of the boys and the women's boys and girls around wraparound services. And that was a good experience. But at that time, that wasn't building hours towards the clinical license. So I had to shift. Yeah. But it's some interesting stories, like as men in this field, it's not a lot of us. And so I've had some instances where, you know, when you're going into somebody's home and, you know, the women, you know, you're helping their son or you're helping their family and they thinking like you there, like that is like, all right, so this a man that's coming in my home, he's helping my child, we're making progress. Like, let me try to take it to the next level. Like I've been like at somebody's house where the kid was supposed to be there, they sent the kid off and they come to the door in a towel.
Yeah,
you know, different stuff like that. Those experiences that happens to a lot of us that we don't really share. So I had to learn some boundaries and some things about put some things in place so none of that stuff happens, mm-hmm. or I can prevent it, or you know, never get sucked in. I never got sucked into anything like that, but the temptation was there and the opportunity was there, and I see how people get caught up. Mm-hmm. But from wraparound, and then I went to child welfare, and I was there for 7 years, and that particular population, I worked with every male client in child welfare from the age 15 to 21 to help them prepare to age out of care, mm-hmm. and I was in charge with all the males, so it was the independent living or transitioning youth. And that was pretty cool as far as like working with the population. But you know, I don't know if you had any experience with working with the bureaucracy, some of the things that we go through as Black men, as just Black people in general, man, that was the shady stuff that went on was necessary for me though, because it was a comfortable position. I can go there and kind of like work my hours and go home, you know, pay was decent. It wasn't great, but the benefits were lovely. But it was also the hours I needed towards the clinical license. Yeah. So it gave me some things, although I went through some trash moments through there. But yeah, that's essentially, and then I moved into private practice, and that's where I'm at now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, that's a journey, you know what I'm saying? Hospice to child welfare, and it was some tough jobs. Like hospice, when I was getting out of grad school, I was like, you know what? I could probably, not getting out of grad school, but going into grad school, I was like, I could probably be a hospice social worker. I'm a pretty, like, you know, stoic guy. I don't really get too caught up in things. But then I had a daughter, and I swear to God, that opened up like a different chamber of emotions. So I'm like, there's no way. I'm not even looking at them jobs, like, because I already know, like, that ain't even.
Mm-mm. Right. Yeah, so that's a person to be able to do that, man.
Yeah, for real. Like, yeah, I commend all y'all hospice social workers. So now you got the private practice going. You know, so how did you, like, build up this practice to be, like, you know, like the ideal platform, the ideal, you know, like your ideal just business?
So I learned the model from my mentor, again, that same gentleman. Also, as I worked in each individual place, like for independent living program, I watched how different therapists came in. They came into the homes and worked with them, whether they connected with them or not. So we have, you know, white therapists, whether they're old ladies or white men, they would come in and kids would just not connect with them. And they used to come and say, Mr. Paul, can you be my therapist? And I was like, well, I'm not in that role. Although I felt like I had some of the skills, that wasn't my position. So I just started developing relationships with each agency. So I had a relationship with the one I left, the independent living one. I had a relationship with the wraparound services, which is community-based. So all those different agencies, I developed relationships, child welfare, and even in DJS, Department of Juvenile Services, I used to always create relationships with them, and then also with the judges as I was coming up, because with child welfare, you in there with the judges, with the program that I was running with the alternative youth through the wraparound services, I created relationships with the judges and the execs. And, you know, I started to say, you know, I'm going to be transitioning soon to private practice. And they said, you know, we need more Black men. It's a struggle. We don't have any Black men. And so once I started doing that, again, I was just like, yo, before I jump out there, let me kind of get my feet wet. And I was taking on, like, again, 10 to 15 clients a week. But the referrals didn't stop coming. They was just too many. And I was just like, all right, let me hold on. All right, let me see when I'm gonna make that move. And, you know, trying to get under that umbrella or being afraid to say, like, I'm totally on my own because I got to handle my own insurance. You know, if a client don't show up, you don't get paid in certain insurances. And so I had to get out of my own head, and I had to really look at numbers and really create this space where saying, like, all right, I got enough saved up. I got my 401k if I need it. But I had, like, at least 3 or 4 months of money saved up at that particular time. And then, like I said, I hit the ground running, and I started working the same hours I was working before, which created that burnout where I was working Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I was like, because I work for the hospital every other weekend, so I might as well have clients. You know, the hospital was paying me like $35 an hour. The clients are paying $100 or, you know, 70 on the low side and 120. So while I was exhausted at, you know, at the end of the day or the middle of the day, a Sunday, when I go and look at that money on Monday, I was like, all right, it's worth it again. Let me go get the bag.
Yeah.
So, but then I realized, yeah. So I see the money, but I don't, you know, I feel like the burnout is coming, and I use the money in the bag as a thing to kind of justify me overworking myself until I got, you know, exhausted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like, I mean, cause I feel like, you know, I feel like we all have that, the idea of, like, you know, we got a master's degree. We got to look like we got a master's degree, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, like, I feel like there's nothing wrong with, like, working hard, but if you but it sounds like you had a goal in mind, right? You know what I'm saying? So like, I feel like it's good that, like, okay, I'm gonna bust my ass for 6 months. because I want to have 4 months salary saved up when I take this leap to like something better. And in Oregon, they say you should have 6 months of a salary saved up because reimbursements take a long time. If you're dealing with OHP, the Oregon Health Plan, they can take a while to, you know what I'm saying, to get back with you. So they say you want like 6 months, you know, just to kind of not be really stretching yourself thin, you know, or, you know, be married and have somebody who can float you for a little bit, you know, whatever way works. But, you know, so, yeah. So, man, something was, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say the biggest thing for me is that my goal was I didn't want to leave the community. Like, I wanted to make sure that I'm in there with the Medicaid clients, like who's in the hood at alternative schools that I used to kind of work with. And I was now planted. I created contracts with them that I was in there 2 days a week. So if I'm in there 2 days a week, you know, Medicaid, they pay weekly. So I'm seeing, you know, 7 to 8 clients 2 days a week. That's 16 clients right there. That's money. Yeah. And so now I got the other stuff on top of that where I'm seeing clients, Medicaid clients. So at that point, and I won't say I set myself up. I knew what I was doing. I said on social media and like one of my stories, I said, I want to double what I'm making in child welfare by this time next year. And so I had that goal. And so I had to work as if I was on. And I mean, again, at child welfare, I've been there 7 years and it was 71,000. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, and it was like, okay, 10 more years and I can get to 100. I was like, I don't want to be like doing this for 10, 20 years to make 100K. Like, and that's a, and I'm not shunning or shaming anybody else who, you know, didn't do that or who has no problem with that. That wasn't my thing. It was just like the stuff that I was going through in there wasn't worth it. Mm-hmm. The lack of attention that I wanted to give the clients, it was more about them, the paperwork and meeting certain things as opposed to really impacting the community and the clients. So if I knew, if I can step out and reach as many people in the community as I could, then I'm gonna do that. And so it was that led me to where the money was. So that's mm-hmm. when I got it to the six figures. And I was like, all right, so let me try to make some more. Let me see what this looks like to double that. And so that's when I got the mindset to kind of like change the game for me.
Okay. And you know, like, and I know what you meant when you were talking about, you know what I'm saying, like, you know, the state jobs and stuff, because there's always like, there's more than one ways to get it, right? You know what I'm saying? And there's freedom, you know what I'm saying? Like, my thing with private practice, I'm not really chasing, like, the bag as much as I'm chasing, like, the freedom to be like, nah, I ain't working with y'all, or I'm not doing that, or I'm going to work with this population because they need my attention right now, or I'm going to take, you know, I'm going to just be able to kind of go speak at places, go do 10 clients over here, go do 15 over here, and then, you know what I'm saying? So, like, just the ability to, like, really make it worth it, like, to kind of get paid and also have your vision of what you thought social work was supposed to be.
Right. Because you know? For me, it was like the purpose gave me the money. You know, to put the impact and the my heart into sincerity, like you were saying, that's what led to the money was the bonus, you know. But, you know, I ain't going to act like I wasn't going to do it for free. I mean, because, you know, some people say, that, is this something that you would do for free? Yeah, I could do it for free if somebody was taking care of all my bills and everything. But, like, I know I need to. That's not the truth. I got a wife. I got a son. I got a daughter. Like, I got to take care of my family. And so, yeah, it was like, let me get on this. And I wanted to provide my son at the time, because I was single at the time, a certain lifestyle. And I didn't want him to not lack. And again, I worked hard in school. And so I wanted to reap the benefits of all my work from school and all the stuff that I've been through. And I wanted to, again, show up differently.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's what we all chasing. And, you know, God willing that I get there soon. I just got approved for a supervision plan that should put me in position in about 8 months. So I've been doing this I've been doing this for about 3 years and I'm tired. You know, I mean, you know, I'll go like you just bored people and you supervise, you change supervisors, you lose work. It's just, it's annoying, but I feel like I just got like my driver's permit and I'm like in the final, stretch, you know what I'm saying? So, but how did you become a relationship coach? I know that's part of your, you know, so that's part of your, know, part of your practice, and like you wrote a book. Yeah, I'll be seeing you on TV, like, you know, just talking about, you know, different things like regarding relationships and things like that. So how did you get in that field?
Again, it was like growing up, it was a lot of friends. I was always around a lot of different girls and stuff like that because it was my sister. It was my female cousin. It was all their friends. I was the only boy in the house. And so they used to always come to me for stuff. I had, again, a lot of female friends and, you know, they asked me different relationship stuff. I was fascinated by relationships. You know, I had this goal of going to college and becoming, meeting my wife as soon as I get there. I used to write raps back in the day and I wasn't hard enough to be that hardcore rapper. So I turned that into songs. And then if you're writing songs, you know, it was love songs because, you know, I wanted to have a girlfriend. All those things were talking about relationships. And once I finally got into the relationship class, the marriage and family class, I was just like, yo, I love this. I love everything about relationships and this makes sense. And then I got into a relationship that didn't work out. And so I was just like, I wanna know why it didn't work out. I wanna start writing as opposed to giving my feelings to people. And so I was just, that was my way of processing the traumatic event that I went through. It went into writing and studying relationships. And that's how I wrote my book. That's how I wrote Dear Future Wife. That's how I started writing that. And that's how I just started commenting on a lot of different things, that thought process that was really kind of like impacting the community. And my, you know, you have your conversations with your homies and you have your conversations with your homegirls. We always had like little groups and we would just talk about stuff, whether we're chilling in a dorm room or in our apartments in college. And everybody was always asking me, "What, Paul, what do you think?" You know, at the time everybody was, it was Paul. So it was like, "What do you think?" I was like, "Well, you know, about different perspective. You know, I understand what the woman is saying because I'm clear because, again, growing up with a lot of women. And so I understand their aspect, but I also understand the man's side as well." And I had to kind of figure that part out. And so, again, people were asking me these questions. So I said, this can be a thing. And so I just started doing that on social media, whether it initially was Facebook. And I just talked about it on Facebook. I just talked about different relationships. It was always a Dear Future Wife stuff. And then people started coming to me and asking me if I can help them. At that time, I wasn't licensed, so I was just coaching. So I was like, yeah, I can, you know, become a coach. Let me coach. But I didn't have any certifications or nothing like that. I was just like, I have a master's degree. I have a LGSW at that time, which is an LMSW now, so graduate license. And so I was just like, I'm coaching, you know, couples. And I was really being effective. But I was kind of like, I don't know what I want to do with that. Like, do I want to continue or do I want to go into like just clinical stuff? And I didn't really understand the difference at the time. And also dealing with imposter syndrome, I'm just like, how can I be a coach and helping these couples? And I ain't married and, you know, so dealing with all that. But once I got past that, I was just like, yeah, this is my bag. This is my niche. This is what I love to do. And my stuff is valid. I was getting validated by, you know, the top therapists in the area, top relationship coaches were seeking me out. So I was like, all right, I know what I'm doing. But the problem was my relationships weren't working because I was applying different things to people that I shouldn't have been in a relationship with. And I was also needed to mature too. You can't be the therapist in your relationship. And so, you know, I learned that along the way. And again, a lot of process trauma, a lot of different bad things that happened in relationships, whether it was me or people around me, that I just wanted people to kind of like not to continue to experience.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's a good little journey. You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like, you know, those things that we kind of specialize in really make us, you know, the social worker we are. Like, even though, you know, it's only a part of your practice. I mean, like the way that kind of blossoms, it's kind of like, you know, if, I'm sure it trickles down to everything else. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, and vice versa. You know what I'm saying? Like some of the stuff you might've learned, like dealing with, you know, the youth and, you know, or whatever, you know what I'm saying? Kind of went to that too. So that's dope. Right. I mean, I never really seen nothing like that. You know what I'm saying? Until like I saw, like, you know what I'm saying? Like all your posts on, you know, like social media. And I was like, man, this is a pretty dope book, you know? So, I mean, I see you, brother, you know what I'm saying? But
appreciate
you know what I'm saying. But so you mentioned working in the community, you know what I'm saying? You know, being from the or you live in the DC area. How do you think that mental health and race are, you know, like, you know, are linked?
In our community, it is so prevalent and we minimize it. I mean, it's getting a lot better, and I will say that. But previously, we had used to say things like, oh, my nerves are bad. You know, that's anxiety. You know, people that describe depression as just like, I'm just constantly sad. I can't do anything. Or we go to a substance, you know, I'm in a bad mood, or little Johnny's always hyper. And then all of a sudden he's down. Like, what's going on? You ain't take your medicine. And in like joking ways, just like, oh, is it a candy that's making you super hyper, when we have to explore what really that is? So we talk about race, and we didn't have a lot of access to really understand what was going on with us. And if we did, a lot of times we're misdiagnosed. Mm-hmm. So you're diagnosing a kid with oppositional defiant disorder when he's really suffering from depression. You're calling the kid saying he has ADHD, and the kid is struggling because when he goes home, there's no place for him to have any focus. Like when he's doing the homework, because there's so many kids living in the house, or the family is always busy, or he's doing the homework at the dinner table while they're cooking and the TV's on, the radio's playing. Like, he can't go into a classroom and ask to be quiet and learn that way when his home environment doesn't provide those parameters of him being able to focus. Now, there is ADHD, and there's real true ADHD, but you know, we don't really understand what that is. Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't at that time. So not having that access to it, and then our just trust with the medical profession. Like, we've been taken advantage of, we've been abused in the medical profession. So it impacts us. And we ain't even get into what's happening to us and what has happened to us historically, systemically. That, let alone, it impacts your mental health. Walking out your house, being afraid or anxious, or having to always protect yourself or be worried if you're going to come home because you're living in the hood and there's an opportunity or there's a chance that you might get hurt. Or, you know, your mom or your dad is working overtime and they're not there for you to have dinner. So you got to make it yourself, you know, parentified youth. It's a whole bunch of, it's so many different layers to that. So when it comes to us, we're battling so many different things.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing I didn't realize was like how these conditions are passed down. You know what I'm saying? Like, I work in a hospital, kind of quasi hospital setting now. And a lot of people that, you know, experience bipolar and, you know, depression and things like that, they always say, well, you know, my sister had it, my mom had it, my dad had it, my grandpa had it. So like, even from like, you know, just like if somebody, you know, 400 years ago had it, well, you know, the first person, of course, they had something, they passed that down. You passed them, you know, them kind of, you know, you just passed that kind of worry down. You know what I'm saying? Like, you passed that stress down, because it's something about growing up in an environment that really takes a toll on you. You know what I'm saying? And also like, so my thing is like, you know, being, you know, saying like being Black in America, it's like, you know, I remember James Baldwin had a saying that like, he can't believe that we all aren't schizophrenic. You know what I'm saying? Just because of, I remember something that shook me up. I was watching this video. This dude in Florida was in the store. He parked in the handicap parking spot, right? And this white guy came and he was like bothering the family, right? Like, just bothering them, you know, whatever. So the dude comes out, of course, pushes the dude, right? Because the person's bothering his wife and kids in the car. The white guy gets pushed on the ground. Tell like he, you know, kind of plants himself, pulls his gun out, shoots him. The guy who shot the Black dude, he got found not guilty because he was standing his ground. Now I'm like, shit, if somebody could antagonize me, I respond, and then I get killed, and then you say he was like, how do you not expect nobody to be going crazy just with that kind of thought, like, man, like, there ain't nothing I can do to defend myself. I can't, you know what I'm saying? Like you expect me to just have like a short life, like, you know what I'm saying? To have a kid, have a couple kids. And then if I run to the wrong person, you know, and try to defend myself, I die. And then that's just it. That's just it. It's over for me. That shook me. That's still shaking me up. I mean, as you can tell, like, that kind of shit, like, cause that ain't, that's, and I'm saying, like, people expect us to, like, just, you know, like, get up every day and deal with this stuff. You know what I'm saying? I left my last job because of hostile environment, and it was an easy cake job, but it was like, I'm not doing that no more. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to live like that. And I feel like if somebody with the resources that, you know, and like, who's mentally sound like me is like struggles, how does somebody else with no resources, you know, feel? And, you know, like, if they can't get help and they can't, you know, like, provide for their family and they, you know, like, stuff like that. And it's.
Yeah, man. Yeah. It's just like you're saying, again, growing up in those environments where you're basically living in fear, you're trying to survive. You can't really, thrive. You can't really live the way that you should be living. And then you're having not only the stuff that's happening inside your house. As soon as you walk out the door, you're done with that. On your way to school, then you get to school, and then you deal with those microaggressions and all those different things, and teachers treating you a certain way because you look a certain way. I remember my mother just actually told me this story, and I had no idea. Like, I've heard this happen to other people where, she said, I was in first grade, and this teacher, and she moved me. We was living in the Bronx, but she found a way to get me into like one of the best schools, public schools in Manhattan, and prestigious like public schools. So I was in that school, and I was in this class, and this teacher came to my mother and told her that I stole $20 out of her purse. And my mother was like, it was a white teacher. My mother was like, I would know if my son, I mean, he's 7 years old. I would know if my son had $20. And where is he going to go? He's with me. I drive him to school, and then I pick him up. Like, what is he going to do with it? Mm. So that didn't work. The next thing that the teacher did was go to the board, because at that particular time, you had to go to the Board of Education to file a complaint. And what she complained was that I was fidgety in class. I was unable to learn in the class, and I had ADHD. That's what she told them. So at that time, I was put through a whole bunch of different tests to find out if I had ADHD. Mm-hmm. So after taking the test, found nothing, no evidence to say I had ADHD. So I was moved to another class. And in that next class, I still don't know what's going on. So I moved to the next class, and I'm the teacher says, I don't know what that teacher was talking about. This is another white teacher. I don't know what that previous teacher was talking about. This is my best student. He's on, you know, he does all his work. He's a leader. He's quiet. And this is my best student. I'm glad to have him in the class. So my mother did more research and started contacting other Black parents in the school that went through a class. And they went, after they did the research, they found out that this teacher was putting every Black student in special ed and telling them they had ADHD. Every Black student in there. And then they had to go back. And then, of course, I don't know if they reprimanded her. I don't know what happened with her, but they just did an investigation. But I mean, thank God that my mother fought. But a lot of times parents don't do that. They was like, oh, okay, we'll put them in the class because I got to go to work. I can't keep missing work to come up here to deal with this because of these stories, you know, because of what the teacher is saying. So I believe the teacher, even if the evidence doesn't show up at home, like what is going on at school, he's good with me. And then we have all those different things that are happening at one time. And a lot of us are finding ourselves dealing with that. And then it happens growing up in the workplace. And it happens in the community. And then it happens, you know, just we see it on TV. We see it on the news. You talk about being shot. We're watching that. It's so much things, so many things we deal with, man.
Yeah, for real. You know, and like kids, like a kid has to deal with that. And then you're not talking about like the environment, you know what I'm saying, you might be living in, because I didn't grow up in the best environment, you know what I'm saying? Like it took a while for, you know, things to kind of smooth out. So yeah, it's just like, man, we just set up to like, you know, live in the hood, go to school, get bullied by people and administration, and go to work and get bullied, and you know, it's just crazy. So, but I'm glad, you know, saying there's people like us who like doing the work and you know, and trying to make it make sense. You know, like I feel like, you know, like the last job I had when I worked in the juvie, like I really wanted the young men to know that it's okay to kind of be yourself. You know, like I feel like I ran away from myself for a long time just because I wasn't quite, I mean, I lived in the hood, but I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't the quintessential hood guy. So like really took me a while to kind of be comfortable to like, just be Chris, yeah, you know? Yeah. So I like, so that's one thing I preach, like be yourself. You're doing okay. You know what I'm saying? So that's like part of like, it's like a cornerstone of my like practice. It's like, you know, it's all right to be yourself. It's okay to, you know, there's no, it's only one you, you know? So.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, I definitely went through some of that too. Cause I was, again, we lived in a hood, but my mother always made sure that I was outside the environment. You know, after public school, I think 10th grade was the last grade that I was in public school. And then I went to private school and I played ball. So I had the environment and, you know, it was just like, if you weren't on the basketball team, you were just wealthy white people or a sprinkle of black people. Mm-hmm. And I used to experience that life too. So I used to go, you know, hang out with them, you know, sleepovers with them. And so I experienced those different things. And then again, we weren't like poor after a certain amount of time. Like my mother, again, she was a property manager. We lived in the hood, but she was a property manager, so there were some benefits to it. Mm. So, you know, my pops and my mom, they didn't have to pay rent, and they didn't, you know, we had the cable, we had, you know, I had the PlayStation or the Atari or whatever, because they didn't have those other bills. And so kind of like sometimes my house was a fun house, but again, you know, everybody can't come over to your house that's in the hood. Like these things pop up missing. Yeah. So, but I was able to experience. And so I went through some kind of like identity stuff too, because, you know, although I lived there, a lot of my experience were outside. So I'm, mm-hmm. again, my mother was like, all right, let's go travel. You know, let's experience these different things. And so we lived in Suffolk, Virginia, but we used to always go to Virginia Beach. So although I lived in the hood, I was at the beach. And so, you know, just those different things I was able to experience, it kind of gives me like a broader view on life in general.
Yes, sir. And we need that, you know, like we definitely need to experience some things that kind of, it makes us better, I think it makes us better social workers, you know what I'm saying? Like this ability to kind of like know different, you know, cultures and different, you know, just different views of life, you know, because everybody who come to your office or, you know, like however you meet with them ain't going to be the same, you know what I'm saying? Right. Like even if they all black, they ain't going to all be the same, you know? So, right. Man, any words of like advice for like people that are trying to build their private practice or build their brand up?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of ones. Like if you're trying to build your private practice, again, create relationships, community involvement, community connection, because that's where your referrals are going to come from. You also want to create some type of mentorship or find a mentor that you can really lean on to kind of help you with some different things. Kind of trust yourself. Don't be afraid to take that leap. I know it's scary. But set up the infrastructure that you have. You'll be able to kind of like support yourself in that when you're building your private practice. There's a lot of different programs, a lot of different people that support specifically us. If you go on Facebook, Clinicians of Color is a great group. Jetta Robinson is a dope person to connect with if you're trying to build your private practice. She knows all the nuances. But there's a lot of different resources out there that can really help you. Again, getting a good mentorship, get a good supervisor, be upfront, kind of challenge your supervisor, kind of experience therapy too, because you want to be on both sides of it, right? You want to know what the clinician's experience is as well as the patient's experience. So, because I have a therapist and I'm in therapy and I provide therapy, so I know what it's like to be on both sides of the couch. I think that's important too. And also you just help get a good sense of grounding because you're about to take on this undertaking of a lot of people's things, a lot of people's stuff, a lot of people's issues, problems, and whatever it is, you're taking that stuff on. So it's going to look different and manage your own business. That's sometimes stressful. And if you're trying to build your brand, the biggest thing is be authentic, because if you're not, it'll show up. Be authentic, consistent. And, you know, don't be afraid to be, like you said, yourself and be outside the box. It wasn't a lot of people when I first started my Dear Future Wife stuff. It wasn't a lot of men talking to other men. It was always men talking to women, telling women what they need to do. And I was just like, that's kind of, I don't want to knock it, so I don't want to say the wrong thing. But for me, I felt like if we're telling women to do everything, but we ain't right, it doesn't matter how good or how perfect that woman is, because it's still not going to work because we ain't got it together. And I felt like we needed a voice because we needed to talk about what we deal with when it comes to vulnerability, what we deal with when it comes to abuse, what we deal with when it comes to the struggles of being a Black man in society, or being a man in society in the relationship space, or dealing with mental illness, or dealing with our mental health, our physical health, emotional wealth, all those good things. We need somebody that's going to be like, all right, I'm willing to talk about it. I'm willing to be vulnerable. I'm willing to be a voice. I'm willing to be accessible. So that's what I say. Again, authenticity. Don't be afraid to ask for help and support. And just do your thing. Trust yourself, man.
Sir, all good. That's all good words. I definitely underestimated, you know what I'm saying, like the power of creating relationships. You know what I'm saying? Everybody that I know that has a private practice, they got some kind of funnel. You know what I'm saying? The lady that I used to subcontract with, her funnel was DHS. you know, my current supervisor that I get supervision from, his funnel was the school district of Portland. He always in their pocket. and then my group supervisor, she does everything. She DHS, county, corrections, Nike, because Nike out here, she do trainings for Nike. You know, she cold. So I appreciate that, you know, that game right there. So you mentioned hip hop earlier. How do you connect like social work and hip hop?
I think it's just what we are. So if we listen to our music, like growing up, again, growing up in the Bronx, the birth of hip hop, and I know Brooklyn want to challenge that. We can have a discussion. But I grew up on Grand Avenue. So Grand Avenue, Grandmaster Flash lived on my block. So when I used to walk to the corner store, they would be outside with their music. And they have, you know, the box, everybody's beatboxing, or they dancing, the B-boys and all that type of stuff. So that, I grew up in that. And then moving to Suffolk, I still had this idea of hip hop. It was a kind of different change, but then growing up and just listening to all types of hip hop, that's what I love. But we talk about change, reform, it's in our music, EPMD. You talk about, like, I remember one of my favorite songs was Self-Destruction. When we talk about all the things that need to happen, they're talking about the violence in the community, and then LA did their version of it. Being able to relate, because that's what music really drives the soul. And so music is really influential into our thought process. So I know music motivates me, like when I go work out. So I'm listening to certain things. I know if I listen to a certain type of music before I go into a therapy session, I might be thrown off. If I go on there, like, goodness, I posted this on Facebook a couple of years ago. I was on my way to see a client, and I had Rick Ross. I think it was the first or second album on. And I was just like, and I came in, and I was just like, it was like, I had a certain, like, kind of like snarl to me, because I was just like, in my music, like, I wasn't trying to be mean, but I was just like, in my, you know, so it was just like that type of thing. So, and again, we are in, when I work for different, like, child welfare, I used to go into the group homes and kind of talk to the kids. And then I would see former athletes or former musicians who were worked in those group homes, and they weren't getting paid any money. And if they would have went the social work route while they was in school, or they would have taken that, they could have did both. They could be in a position that I am, be influential, still get back to the community, because that's what we all say, right? I want to get my money and get back to the community. And so I was pushing that for a while, telling my athletes, when you go to school, you know, everybody wants to do the sports management is easy, or everybody wants to do, you know, these, whatever those degrees are, general studies. But if you get a social work degree, you have a career that's rewarding, and it also gives you community connection. Mm-hmm. So that's how I combine, like, well, how hip hop and social work and everything, because, and a lot of times we have social workers in our communities who are there helping us out. And, you know, the person that comes in and say, yo, let's change. Oh, hold, let me provide this resource. Let me connect you with this person. And that's, you know, some of the aspects and the core values of social work.
Sure. Yeah. Man, you just reminded me of, man, of that same gang, song that was we used to bump that on here on the West Coast. That was our movement. That was because, you know, because it was real. Like, I mean, Portland, not so much as L.A., but we still was, it trickled up here, you know what I'm saying? And we still was trying to just get the communities to figure it out. So I remember that being a thing, like a big movement, you know?
Yeah.
How do you practice self-care?
Oh, man. So now I have Mondays. Mondays, I don't do anything. Monday is my self-care day. It's even on my answer machine. I said, if you call me on Monday, I'm not going to pick up the phone. My phone is on do not disturb. I'll give you that. And my 24 hours doesn't start until Tuesday morning to get back to you. Like, that's literally on my answer machine. And so I set boundaries. That's how I do self-care. I love to travel. I try to travel every quarter. COVID it got in the way of that a little bit this year, but I'm starting to travel again. So that music, again, that I love music, cooking, spending time with my family, that self-care, working out, writing is self-care for me. And sometimes even sessions, like when I'm in certain sessions and stuff like that, some of that is self-care. If I'm like really struggling with some of my own stuff, I was getting in sessions and be like, all right, let me kind of like get away from my own stuff and then jump into somebody else's stuff and help them. And some of the feedback sometimes it provides self-care because I was effective today. I helped the person out today. So I showed up today. So that's self-care too. Yeah. Those things are self-care. I love, like for me, I love certain smells like Bath and Body Works. I used to steal my sister's stuff back in the day. Be like, let me take a little shower. I'm all smelling all like jasmine, vanilla. Oh, they just smell good, but I didn't need to wear it. I mean, it's just like, I know when I start dating, like I want somebody that, you know, that I'm dating to kind of have a certain, you know, scent or whatever. But today I like certain smells and I realized the aromatherapy stuff is actually calming. So really understanding what impact or what effects it's having on us was a crucial step in really understanding different nuances and understanding of self-care. Yeah, man.
For sure, man. Well, man, I appreciate you for joining me. You know what I'm saying? Like I said, man, you are goals for real. I see you. You drive good. You live good. You know what I'm saying? You're always looking like you're clean and sharp, man. You know what I'm saying? I don't mean to sound anything like, you know, off, but like, it looked like you always smell good too, brother. I'm just going to keep it real.
Hey, look, let me tell you, it was a funny story because what I be doing, like some days I don't feel like shaving my whole head. So I'll literally shave this part right here and that part be all bushy. And I'll be showing my clients like this, like I, and they think I got it all together. Or if I do a live, even if I go on TV or something like that, it'd be just a front like that. And then and my wife makes fun of me because I'll go in there and I'll spray some cologne because I want to smell a certain way before I go in a session. She's like, why are you putting on cologne? You just going to the other room. I just like to smell good. I like to smell good. It puts me in this mind frame and I even shower before I work out. So it's like all those things, I know what works for me. And not that, like you said, be authentic, be true to yourself, be yourself. Don't be afraid to be that. So yeah, I take that as a compliment, bro. I appreciate it
for real. Cause I'm like, okay, yeah, goals for real. You and a few others, OG social workers that I see, because you know, a lot of people, I'm really glad that I created this platform, not even for like just to spread the word for my damn self, because a lot of people will just show you like one side of social work, you know, case management, paper pushing, you know, kind of, you know, bounce from place to place, which that's, I'm not knocking it, but I'm glad that I see a lane that I can create or that I can kind of be a part of, you know what I'm saying? So I appreciate you and everybody else that I follow who doing their thing, you know what I'm saying? I appreciate all y'all. So yeah, man, appreciate you for coming and sharing your wealth of knowledge, you know what I'm saying, with the people who are going to listen to this podcast.
Yeah. I appreciate you for having me, man. I think it's, like I said, hip hop, anything hip hop, I'm down, man. So, I think it's dope. You know, I watch you as well. You got followers too. You got a following too. So, you popping too. So that's a good thing. Well, we're gonna stay connected, man. We're gonna keep reaching the community because they need to know the connection, man, and they need us, and we need them.
For sure. All right, bro. Well, then, yeah. So, signing off, man. Peace.
All right.